Well, it has been a woefully long time that I have been hoping to get the Connecticut Justice Alliance and its representatives on the award winning For the People. And I got them now. I'm so happy and honored to have a couple of critical folks for this organization on the program. We're going to meet Jordan Wilson, their director of community engagement, and their executive director, Christina Quaranta, in just a few moments. But we want to remind you that thanks to support being provided by the community, including listeners to the award-winning For the People, Ruth's House is transforming the lives of single moms by providing families with access to mentorship, helping moms go back to school, accessing job training, learning new skills, educating their children, and most importantly, ensuring that moms don't feel alone. Your support is creating a home full of possibilities. Through every program, relationship, and opportunity, you're fostering hope, opening doors, and helping moms find their way to a brighter future. If you'd like to learn more or lend support to one of these moms, just visit RuthsHouseCT.com. All right. Well, we are so pleased to have representatives from the Connecticut Justice Alliance on the program this morning. This organization has released its legislative priorities for the 2025 session as outlined in their annual State of Youth Justice Report. And we're going to be talking all about that agenda, some other elements of the report, and basically orienting you on what the Connecticut Justice Alliance is all about. Jordan Wilson is here, as we mentioned, Director of Community Engagement, and Executive Director Christina Quaranta. We'll get to Christina in just a few moments. But Jordan, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So for folks that are listening that may have heard about the Justice Alliance, and more importantly, for those who haven't, unpack a little bit about what they need to know.
Of course. So the Connecticut Justice Alliance is a youth-adult partnership that works to end the criminalization of youth. We're a statewide organization, and we work directly with young people that have been impacted by the system. We refer to them as justice advisors. We currently have about 9 on our team, and they have first or secondhand experience with the system. So they've either been incarcerated themselves, their family members have been incarcerated, they've been detained, they've gone through the court system. And we believe that their experience is their expertise, and we make sure that communities hear from them, the legislature hears from them. We train them up in political advocacy and social justice issues. And we just, you know, make sure that they have all the resources that they need to be successful advocates for Connecticut's youth.
Very good. What gets you out the door and into work every morning? What are a couple of the things that really, really excite your passion about working for the Alliance?
I love working with our justice advisors. I love working with our young people. But honestly, for me, I'm a new mom. Well, I guess not new anymore, but I have a 2-year-old. Who will eventually grow up to be a Black man in America, but he's, you know, until then, he'll be a Black young person in America. And I don't want to continue living in a world, especially in a state, that currently arrests Black and brown children as young as 7 or as young as 10, recently changed over the past 2 years. And so that gets me out the door every day, just working to transform the system and create better communities and a better world for him. And all of our young people, but definitely mine.
All right. Christina, it sounds like she's a keeper.
She is. I love Jordan.
Christina Quaranta, the voice you hear now, Executive Director for the Connecticut Justice Alliance. Christina, I understand you both have had a super busy morning. I really appreciate you making the time to spend another 10 or 12 minutes with us talking a little bit about the State of Youth Justice Report, which in part reflects on some of the greatest successes of the Alliance over the past year. Hit us with a 2 or 3 that you're most proud of.
Thank you. So some of the greatest successes that TTJA has accomplished, and those can really be credited to the hard work of the justice advisors that we work with, are getting into different community spaces, places where young people are detained or incarcerated, and having honest and raw conversations with them about what brought them to that place in life, what could help them, and what do they need when they eventually return home, or if they are home, how things are working out for them. the justice advisors themselves have become really skilled at holding conversations with different types of people. So whether it's young people, police officers, correctional officers, legislators, to siphon out all of that information and then be able to funnel it back to those that are making decisions when it comes to spending priorities for Connecticut, so that the investments that Connecticut makes are made in the right places, in the right communities, so that we can have a just and safe Connecticut for all people. I think that's a huge success. And one more that I would mention is the state has a legislatively mandated body called the Juvenile Justice Policy and Oversight Committee. Now, some might know that from watching it on TPN or attending it in person, but that table is filled with lots of adults and sort of folks that come to work every day to work with young people, whether you are a warden of a prison or you are running programs in the community, whether you're a legislator, right? There weren't young faces at that table. And we worked hard the past couple of years to have young people have a voting seat at that table and be able to speak at the microphone about the policies that affect them so that they have voice and choice in it. I'm very proud of that. And we will now be moving towards actually appointing young people to those seats and getting them right there on CTN in front. Center.
Excellent. I'd like to just drill in a little deeper into something that you mentioned, and that is the critical allies that you can find within the law enforcement and criminal justice communities that can help both minimize the stigma that younger folks who may be flirting with trouble need to have in order to break out from the wrong direction that they're heading and make a turnaround in their lives.
That's a great question, because there's often a misperception, miscommunication about what safety is and what it means to all people. It doesn't have the same definition, and something else that's different for folks depending on what communities they are from, what job or career they hold, even the color of their skin or what gender they identify with, right? Like, what is safety to them is different. So in our about 22 years of work, and really in the past 8 years and working with the justice advisors and finding allies in the law enforcement community, within the Department of Correction, within the judicial branch, that understand what it means to really work with people, address the root causes of crime and behavior, to kind of put the money where it needs to be, has been key. Folks have different opinions on what it looks like to work with those who are actually a part of the systems that cause harm to young people. But it's of my opinion and CTJ's overall opinion, for the most part, that you have to talk to everyone. You have to bring everyone into the conversation, because in order to come to a solution that will work for all people, you need to ask all of the people, right? So we absolutely have allies, friends, close friends even, in those areas of work, law enforcement, et cetera, that have said, hey, Christina, Jordan, all of our justice advisors, we understand how what we do may impact young people negatively. How can we do it better? What could we do differently? Can we be bringing social workers to the picture? How can we change who we arrest? How can I better understand what opportunities exist for diversion for kids? All of these questions. And so we are happy to answer those and connect them with the folks that can if we cannot. And also just to elevate that, because lots of times folks who work in the police departments, our correctional officers, the list continues, get sort of a black cloud over them if they do not have any sort of goodwill to the people that they are in charge of daily, right? Or that they are, and that's not true. And I think it's important to humanize both sides here, because they also go through traumatic events. And I just think it's important to have allies in all areas. We all want the same thing. And I think people lose sight of that. We all want a safe and just and fair Connecticut. And we know what's going to get us there. And it's not more incarceration, detainment, prison. It's not being able to arrest 10-year-olds, and it's not putting kids who are charged as adults in adult prison. It's just not. Like, that does not deliver the outcomes and other people's definition of safety. So it's so important to work collaboratively on that.
Yeah, and that leads us very, very appropriately into our focus on CTJA's 2025 legislative agenda, primary in which is removing youth from adult facilities. How much of an issue is this in Connecticut? Do you have some idea the proportion of young people that are segmented into juvenile exclusive facilities versus facilities where they're sharing some or all of their day with adults?
Yes, we do have the numbers, and there will be updated numbers even shared a week from today at that statewide meeting that we will share out in some form of fact sheet in a sort of like a constant contact blast so people can sign up for that newsletter.
Okay.
We have an idea of the number of young people. The important thing to highlight here is the number of kids charged as adults in the adult correctional system here in Connecticut is under 60. And so there are about 53 kids, young men today at the Manson Youth Institution, and there could be anywhere between 1 and 3 young women at York Correctional Institution that hold adult charges. Mm. And there have been fits and starts, right, of moving them out of the Department of Corrections jurisdiction and underneath the judicial branch where other kids are housed with, let's say, charges, you know, for other youth. And the difference in programming between the Department of Correction and the judicial branch is stark. Everyone is aware of that. And it's just sort of getting everybody to come to the table and agree on what we are willing to do, how much money we're willing to spend, and really put our feet down and say enough is enough, like enough time has gone by.
Yeah.
We have the science. We know what works. We can follow other states' footsteps and moving kids out of that adult system. So let's just do that. And we are going to be really lighting the fire this session to push people to have to do that.
Mm. There has been some controversy over another one of your legislative agenda items, which is raising the minimum age of arrest. Given the post-COVID era issues that Connecticut has been seeing with younger people involved in things like auto theft and some crimes against property and persons and vandalism and things like that. Tell us a little bit about why it's so important to look at the raising of the minimum age of arrest in terms of, you know, giving those youths just a little extra chance and another choice besides just mainlining them into a criminal justice system that may inevitably end in incarceration.
Well, and Jordan can add to this, so I'll keep my piece short, but
yeah.
It's important because we know that the brain's not done developing until at least age 25. Kids are impulsive, and I'm not saying that it's okay to commit a crime, but kids need second chances. The proper intervention is not handcuffs, detainment, isolation, arrest, incarceration, or any of the consequences that come with any of those things. The proper intervention for a young person under the age of 14, which is what we are asking for, is behavioral health care, mental health care, and basic needs being met, really hitting that root cause.
Mm.
Because otherwise, if you are addressing sort of an adolescent issue, a basic need issue, or frankly, any issue in general, with this wrong intervention of punishment, incarceration, et cetera, the issue is going to persist. And then you will have a 15, 16, 17, 18-year-old still doing the same things because they did not have their needs met and they did not learn any new skills from the consequence. And Jordan, if you would like to add, please do.
I mean, I definitely think you're hitting it right on the head, right? So, you know, as a statewide organization, we're out there talking to communities. So that includes schools. That includes this age group of kids. We're also at Manson Youth Institution talking to those 15 to 17-year-olds and asking them, you know, what do you think should happen with a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old that's committing crimes? Should they be arrested? What type of services should they be receiving? And oftentimes they will tell you that they don't believe that the current placement that they're in works for them. Oftentimes we're hearing them say that it is those behavioral health, mental health services, even diversion and just access to credible messengers that will really do, credible messengers and mentors, that will really do them a better service than something as punitive as going through the court or being incarcerated and housed and detained.
Mm. Mm-hmm. The major, other major point that you folks are looking at for the 2025 legislative agenda is ending harmful practices against youth. Is this becoming the practices that you're defining here, solitary confinement, restraints, chemical agents? Do you find that these are becoming more widespread, or they are simply still being applied in particular situations when science and other studies and information would lead us to now understand that those are not only counterproductive to the end result, but harmful to the individuals involved?
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. So there is different data depending on what length of time you're looking at. It looks like since sort of the intense part of the pandemic has wound down, chemical agent use has upticked in some months. Sometimes in the months that are more closely related to holidays, where some kids might be more emotional, you know, we have that data. I think that the issue is what you pointed out is the use of chemical agent is harmful to the child and to the person who has to administer it. And they do not use chemical agents on young people that are in the judicial branch, nor in schools. Police and correctional officers are the only people that are allowed to use that. You have to be certified to use it. I have had many conversations with correctional officers about this topic and kids inside of facilities where they are pepper sprayed, where chemicals are used. There have been varying responses, and they, if I have to summarize it, I would say that most agree that the solution to not having a chemical agent as your first sort of line of defense instead of having a physical altercation is not ideal. They would like to be able to have ways to have relationships built up and the trust, which we have seen inside of the TRU unit. They do not have to deploy chemical agent use inside of the TRU unit in Cheshire Correctional because of how that program runs, right? But that is not the same across the street as a youth institution. And we'd like to help the correction officers that work there, the wardens and dep warden there, to be able to have that same atmosphere while the kids are still there. So it is better for everyone. And that means the correctional officers too, the children. I think that just leads to a better setting, right? You don't have to worry about them. You don't have to worry about having to pull it out of your belt, right? Like if you need it, if it's an emergency, fine. But there should be other ways. And I think that people would find relief in that. And folks have expressed.
Yeah, it shouldn't be the first go-to. It should be the very last.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. Yeah.
All right. Well, it sounds like the CTJA has its work cut out for the next legislative session. But I mean, these three points are just kind of scratching the surface on what you do. And they're rooted in so much common sense and supported by so much science and practical experience that I hope the lawmakers who are working with you, no matter which side of the aisle they are on, can find some sense in these initiatives and support them as well. Our Connoisseur Media family wishes you guys good luck in your mission. The Connecticut Justice Alliance's 2025 agenda reflects its mission to protect youth rights and ensure Connecticut's legal system adopts evidence-based rehabilitative approaches to youth engagement. CTJA is going to work closely with legislators, community leaders, families, and youth to secure these reforms. We hope you'll support them and learn more about CTJA by going to their website, ctja.org. We are so pleased to make the acquaintance of Jordan Wilson, who is a Director of Community Engagement, and Christina Quaranta, Executive Director of the Connecticut Justice Alliance. Thank you both so much for your time this morning. Best of luck in the session, and we'll probably touch base at some point during the last segment of the session to see how things are going and see if we need to kick some support into gear to get these things over the finish line. So thank you all in the meantime.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.